My castaway this week is a writer. A clever North London boy, he graduated from Oxford to the review pages of the Upmarket Press, where his views on the latest books and the latest television programmes earned him a reputation as a clever writer. By the time he was 34, he published his first novel, Metroland, which won him his first literary prize. Since then, he's written another 8 and won 3 more, most famously perhaps for Flaubert's Parrot, a mixture of biography, criticism and fiction that links its author to his love of France and its culture. Widely admired here in Britain and abroad, he's been translated into 30 languages, he nevertheless remains somewhat enigmatic. The writer makes the rules about what you talk about, he says. He is Julian Barnes. Do I take it from that, Julian, that you just don't like being interviewed?
It depends on the interviewer.
Somebody described it as trying to get blood from a turnip.
Yes, I have my turnip moments, it's true.
Have you very firm and proper professional reasons to justify not liking being interviewed, or is it simply that you find it an uncomfortable experience?
I find it vaguely uncomfortable. There's a sort of presumption of intimacy, which is false. The other thing is that if you're a writer, you're often asked questions about your books which invite you to simplify your books. The question that you're often asked is, what were you trying to say in such and such a novel? To which the answer is, what I was trying to say was what I did say. And the answers are really in the books. And what you are too often, perhaps, invited to do is either reduce fiction to autobiography or reduce a sort of complex novelistic structure to some Christmas cracker motto. Some little piece of wisdom, which is what you were really trying to say all along.
But there is a lot of autobiography in your novels, isn't there? I mean, you couldn't write unless... I mean, I think you said yourself that novel writing is one of blending your own personality into a world of your creation. So you're in there.
Well, I wrote the books, that's true. And at times there are moments when my own personal experience might be used untranslated. But what's interesting about fiction writers, it seems to me, is what they make up, how they transform what they see rather than what they see.
Let me try out on you then what I think I have spotted in your novels about the writer Julian Barnes. I conclude, obviously, that he has an enormously high regard for Flaubert, if not for his Parrot, that he is an atheist, that he's an ardent Leicester City fan, that he enjoys sex, that he thinks love is more important than anything else in the world, and that he fears, above all things, death. Is that a fair summary?
I fear death, that's true, and I fear Leicester City getting relegated. I don't think I'm an atheist. I'd say I'm an agnostic.
You have a high regard for Flaubert.
I have a high regard for Flaubert. And who could go on this programme and deny that they liked sex?
And love?
Well, who could deny that they thought that love was important?
More of that to come. Tell me about your first record.
My first record is Pergolesi's Starbet Marta, which is one of the most beautiful works I've discovered in the last few years. You can also treat it as a basic test of humanity, in that this is the O quam tristis, and if at a point about 25 seconds in your heart doesn't turn over, then I think there's something wrong with you.
Quam Tristis from Pergolesi's Starbet Marta, sung by June Anderson and Cecilia Bartoli with the Sinfonietta de Montreal, conducted by Charles Dutoit. Did you always intend to write, Julian, or you know, was it always on the cards?
No, it wasn't on the cards. I was brought up in a household where there were books and books were respected. Both my parents taught French.
School teachers, yes.
But it wasn't a background in which it seemed an obvious or defensible thing to do to actually practice the arts rather than enjoy them.
You went up to Oxford and were spectacularly inactive, you said. Do you think more so than most? Or?
Yes, I think more so than most. You know, I didn't work particularly hard. I didn't do all those things you're meant to do.
But you were a bookish sort of chap, as you said, and it was a bookish household. I mean, did you go off, as Christopher did in Metroland, to Sunday tea with relations, always clutching a book, always wanting to stick your nose in
it? Oh, no, I didn't. No, I know. No, you see, immediately, that's something that I made up in one of my books. I don't think I would have been allowed to go to tea with my grandparents clutching a book. That would have been impolite.
But were you a francophile schoolboy like Christopher? Did you sort of speak in sophisticated franglais with your chums?
No, I made a bit of that up. I was certainly a francophile. I studied French and Russian at school. I think from that point on, even though at the start there was probably an element of snobbery about it, several of my most important intellectual points of reference are French rather than British.
So you didn't rush round disrupting respectable Londoners in an attempt to épater la bourgeoisie?
No, no, I was much too timid.
It's all fiction, this, isn't it?
Yes, amazing what you can make up, isn't it?
You didn't lose your virginity in Paris during Les Evénements?
No, I didn't, no. Absolutely, I wasn't in Paris during Les Evénements.
I agree. But it's sad because, in fact, you write about that episode of Christopher losing his virginity, and it's terribly touching. It's not at all embarrassing, as sometimes descriptions of adolescent sex can be. So somehow one was convinced that it probably was true.
Yes, it's funny. I mean, Metroland finally came out in French about a year ago, and there was a little programme about it on French television, and they took me to an area of northern Paris, and I didn't know why they were taking me there, and they sat me down on a park bench, and they said, do you know where you are? And I sort of said, roughly, and they said, because it's just here, in fact, in that building over there, that Christopher, I mean you, lost his virginity. And they were terribly dashed when I said, actually, I made it up.
It's terribly sad, that. Why did it take you so long to write, though? It took you 8 years, Metroland, your first novel.
Yes.
Why so long?
Oh, lack of self-confidence. I didn't think I knew what I was doing. I didn't think that I had the justification to be a novelist, which seemed an incredibly sort of grand and grown-up thing to be.
But then it won the Somerset Maugham Prize, so that did something for the confidence, presumably.
Yes, it did, yes. And after that, I published a novel roughly every 2 years since.
Record number two.
Record number two is the great voice of post-war French song, even though he was himself a Belgian, Jacques Brel, a great singer whom I saw on his final singing tour of France in 1967 before he retired and went off to the South Seas. So, A, the voice, B, the fact that I saw him, and C, if I'm going to be on a desert island somewhere in the South Seas, I assume. Brel, interestingly, is buried on the same island and in the same cemetery as Gauguin.
Mon père disait, c'est le vent du nord qui fait craquer les digues à Scheveningen. A Scheveningen petit, tellement fort qu'on ne sait plus qui navigue la mer du Nord, bien les digues. C'est le vent du Nord qui transperce les yeux des hommes du Nord, jeunes ou vieux.
Jacques Brel and Mon Père disait. So you didn't, on graduating, Julian Barnes, have the confidence to write. In fact, you became a lexicographer for the OED supplement in what you've called the Sex and Dirty Words department. What did you have to do?
That's my description of the department rather than the Oxford University Press's description of the department. I had to research the history of words which had come into the language or usages which had come into the language since about 1880.
It's a pretty solitary job, but one which I dare say appealed to your sense of precision, your love of facts, your orderliness, because that is true about you, isn't it?
Yes, though I think it appealed to me because I was only offered two jobs in the 9 months after I left university. And the first was as a tax inspector and the second was as a lexicographer.
Guess which I chose, yes.
but
there is an orderliness about you. I mean, as I struggle here to find out something about Julian Barnes, I mean, let me ask you about a more recent experience. You were for 5 years recently the London correspondent of The New Yorker, and they have a fact-checking department. They checked everything you wrote, and you liked that, didn't you?
It was good to write for them because you knew that they would check everything. I wrote a piece about the Duke of Edinburgh's Committee for the Redesign of Coins and Medals, which meets in Buckingham Palace. And one of my informants said that as you walked up the stairs to this office, there was a Landseer of such and such a subject on the wall. So I put this into the piece. And the fact-checker, after about 15 conversations on the piece, said, "Oh, by the way, we are having a bit of trouble with the Landseer." And I said, flippantly, "Oh, well, why don't you ring up Buckingham Palace?" And he said, "Oh, I have rung up Buckingham Palace. It's just the trouble is that they refuse to confirm or deny whether there is such a Landseer in the palace."
But you approve of, I'm hanging on to my point here, you approve, yes, of that kind of precision. And it's also true, is it not, that Flaubert was also very precise in that kind of way, approved of that kind of thing?
Yes, he did.
It's also true, isn't it, that Flaubert studied law for a while and then abandoned it, which you did too, didn't you?
Yes, I hadn't thought of that. Further similarity is we both studied it with a certain amount of boredom and indifference and were relieved when we were allowed to stop studying it.
But is there more than coincidence here? Do you see a lot of yourself in Flaubert, or do you design yourself?
No.
I don't know. No,
I mean, the other big difference between us is he's French and he's dead. I'm drawn to him because he is the writer's writer par excellence. He's the saint and perhaps the martyr of literature. He's the man who invented the modern novel, in my view. But because he's foreign and that far away, you don't want to write like him now.
But there are many things that you quote him or seem to quote him. I'm not sure whether they're actually direct quotes from him or not. I mean, let me try some out on
you. Yes.
"I pigeonhole my life and keep everything in its place. I'm as full of old drawers and compartments as an old travelling trunk."
That's wonderful, isn't it? That's him, that's not me.
You. You're a collector, you're a hoarder, aren't you?
I'm sort of a collector. I don't know whether I pigeonhole my life.
But you do keep old tickets and programmes and scrapbooks. We're back to this orderliness and neatness. You've got a record of your life tucked away in your room, I read.
Yes, that's true.
Let me try a last one on you. "Deep within, there is a radical, intimate and incessant boredom which prevents me from enjoying anything and which smothers my soul."
No, he was, it's true, restless, out of a sometimes unquenchable boredom. That's not one of my weaknesses or one of my things that irritate me into writing at all. I still feel as if I'm very interested in the world.
Record number three
is the wonderful old Shaker song, Simple Gifts, as set by Aaron Copland. I like the whole set of old American songs that he wrote. But this one in particular seems to demonstrate and remind us of a tremendous sort of hopefulness that in the 19th century and earlier, people could go off and start a new life elsewhere in a different way, according to their own principles. And that is something that it seems to me has completely gone from the modern world. Now, we all tend, unless we want to live in an ashram or become survivalists in Montana, we all tend to live in roughly the same way, and there aren't new ways to discover of living. And this is about a new way.
"'Tis the gift to be simple, 'tis the gift to be free, 'tis the gift to come down where you ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we shan't be ashamed to turn
turn will be our delight, till by turning, turning we come round right.
Simple Gift, sung by William Warfield with the Columbia Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Aaron Copland. So we got to Julian Barnes in his 20s, Oxford graduate in modern languages, lexicographer turned student lawyer, shy, rather quiet, lacking in confidence, who turns to book reviewing. Apparently at your first attempt, which was for Martin Amis on The New Statesman, I think, he asked you to review a selection of books, and then you reviewed all 10 at a breathless pace.
This is true. This was one of my early debacles as a reviewer. I thought that if you were sent 10 books, then that's what you were meant to do, and I devoted a sort of fair 85 words to each of them.
But it was Amis who gave you your first break, was it?
No, it wasn't, actually. Early on, I worked for him on the TLS, but before that I had work elsewhere, yes.
But obviously a friendship with him developed. But you were literary rivals as well as friends. Is it the case that you used to read the final draft of each other's novels?
Yes, that's true, though I don't think that makes us rivals.
Only in the friendliest sense. I mean, you were two people who knew each other who wrote and swapped novels.
Yes, that's right. No, we used to read the proof, not the final draft, but the proof of one another's works. The thinking behind it was that at that late stage, you couldn't say, by the way, this is completely hopeless. Throw it away, think again. You could only say, the style in that sentence is a bit wrong, or this is a repetition, or whatever.
But you've said before now, and again, I don't know how you said it, because I've only seen it in cold print, but let me quote you. Perhaps, and this is of Amis, perhaps beneath our relaxed admiration for one another's work lies the rage to kill.
Yes, that was a joke.
All right. But you did fall out in the end with Amis. Are you now on speaking terms again?
I think it's private business.
Right. But the result of your friendship with him and with others in a kind of North London literary circle, you became known as being a kind of clever, jokey clique of knowing literateurs, I think somebody put, who could ruin literary, a kind of literary mafia. Do you plead guilty to that?
The word mafia, yes. If there was a literary mafia, I wonder what we'd do.
Well, ruin reputations, really, sort of put it about that somebody's work wasn't any good.
But all writers do that, I mean, nothing special about that. If you're using words like mafia or establishment, then what you're talking about is power. Power resides, it seems to me, with the people who actually buy the books, whether they are readers or publishers. But if you're a writer of such stuff, most of the time you spend at home writing it.
Record number four.
Record number four is chosen for associative reasons. It's King Oliver and Struggle Buggy. But this doesn't remind me of America. This reminds me of France. I think one of the times at which I'm most content is setting off in the beginning of an evening for my dinner, driving through French countryside with the sun setting and the vineyards running away from one like green corduroy. And then one naturally has one's dinner. And coming back, I will often play this particular record. And I'm sure on my island it would return France to me.
King Oliver and his orchestra and Struggle Buggy. In every article I've read about you, Julian Barnes, there's mention of the desk at which you write. So as this is radio, I'm afraid you have to describe it to me. It's large, I understand, and it's purpose-built, is it?
I sort of designed this desk and had it built And all sorts of complications ensued, and the carpenter who built it nearly went bankrupt as a result. But a friend borrowed the house, who was also a writer, and said afterwards, as he sat at my desk, it felt like being an American newscaster. And he was sort of kept turning to the right to see where the sort of the weather girl was, and she wasn't there.
But you write to order. You demand of yourself that you go in at a certain time of day and sit there till you've done whatever.
It doesn't really work that I make myself go in and write X hundred words a day. In a funny sort of way, it often operates negatively, that I realise that if I don't write something every day, or at least one day in two, that I get discontented, that a sort of non-specific discontent begins to invade me.
So you enjoy the act of writing. There is a pleasure in it. You don't indulge in any of these delaying tactics that some writers report.
I love writing. It gives me immense pleasure doing it.
You write and you rewrite, don't you? You hone it.
Yes. I mean, I think most writing is in the rewriting. I think writers vary according to how swiftly and smoothly their first draft comes. But the serious writing often begins only after that first draft has been knocked out. Flaubert, to quote him, said, prose is like hair, it shines with combing.
But you also have to make a living at this. I mean, does that come into the reckoning? Do you think, my God, you know, what's my next book going to be about? I need the advance. I mean, is there always something there ripening up in your head, or do you panic?
I'm not happy writing a novel unless I know what the next project is likely to be. I think that's part of necessary psychologically stabilising.
What, the one after the one you're writing?
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, it's like the alcoholic who is only happy with the whiskey if he can see another one lined up on the shelf above him, just within the eye line.
More music.
Record number 5 is again associational, and it's a sort of landscape association. I've taken, in the last few years, to going for long tramps in the English countryside. I think the connection is between mortification of the flesh over 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 miles, and then getting in to your car, and the first thing you put on the radio is Brahms's sumptuous first sextet, Opus 18.
Part of Brahms' String Sextet No. 1 in B-flat major, played by Yehudi Menuhin, Robert Masters, Cecil Aronovitz, Ernst Wallfisch, Morris Gendron and Derek Simpson. I think I'm right in saying, Julian Barnes, that the history of the world in 10.5 chapters has been your bestseller, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Dare I say that might be partly because people thought they were buying the kind of ultimate historical crib, that they were going to be served up all human knowledge in 10.5 chapters.
Well, maybe, in which case it was a very cunning title.
But a very accessible bit, well, it seems to be superficially accessible anyway, is the last chapter, which deals with the Barnes view of heaven, in which Leicester City wins the cup and food is endless breakfasts with crispy bacon rind served separately, and there's loads of sex and shopping. It's pretty cynical stuff. I mean, this is one of those questions you don't like, but what are you trying to tell us?
What I did tell you. It's not the Barnes view of heaven. It was an attempt to cast in fictional form a sort of current view of heaven, which is that heaven is actually remarkably like real life, except you've had the nose job, or you know, the breast enlargement, or you don't have to make the dinner, and so on and so forth, which seems to me imaginatively and spiritually reduced. I mean, I'm an agnostic, but I hope that if there is some sort of afterlife or alternate life, that God has been imaginative, has been enough of a fiction maker to make something a bit different from what we've got at the moment.
But the half chapter of the Ten and a Half tells us, and it states that this is Julian Barnes speaking. I don't know whether we should believe it, but that's what it says.
It doesn't state that it is Julian Barnes. It asks you the question.
It says that then this is Julian Barnes speaking at one point.
It doesn't quite put it like that.
Well, it mentions your name.
It mentions my name, I agree.
Claims authorship, surely.
Not quite.
All right. Well, let me ask you about it. It says that love is what it's all about, the world, that love is our only hope. It becomes evangelical, really. It says how you cuddle in the dark governs how you see the history of the world. Well, is that you speaking, then?
All fiction is fiction. This is a point where it comes closest to being autobiography, yes.
Would you agree, then, if I can try and pin you down to a theme, if there are themes at all in your books, that love is a fairly constant theme, if not love bordering on obsession?
I think, yes, I write about love a fair amount. I write about lots of other things a fair amount. I don't know what my prime subject matter is. I leave that to people who look at my work from the outside.
Well, love pops up more than most, I would say.
Okay.
Enigmatic to the end, you see. More music.
Well, as we were talking about love, this is a piece of wonderful late romanticism. César Franck's Violin Sonata, one of the things I love about it is when you get to late romanticism and a sort of soaring and swooping emotions which seem to sort of burst the form in which they're in are displayed in a comparatively austere form like the Violin Sonata.
Part of César Franck's Sonata for Violin and Piano in A Major, played by Isaac Stern and Alexander Zarkin. If love is a theme of yours, Julian, then death is also, because it crops up again and again in your books, from Metroland and Staring at the Sun to History of the World. Let me ask again, Christopher in Metroland says he's scared to death of death. Are you scared of death?
Yes, absolutely. What he also says is, I wouldn't mind dying if I didn't end up dead at the end of it. And that seems to me a sort of fairly sound approach to the matter.
It's the being dead.
Yeah, it's the being dead.
The non-existence.
The non-existence, the eternity of non-existence, or the probability of an eternity of non-existence.
But did yours begin in adolescence, like Christopher's? He says that the arrival of the fear of the big D was linked to the departure of God.
Yes. Now, I confess to you that that part is absolutely autobiographical and absolutely true. And it's also the case that the fear of death would always arrive at a certain time after the lights had been turned out, and always when I was sleeping on one particular side. And to this day, I sleep on the other side.
But it's more than just a sort of passing fear of being dead, is it? It's a kind of paralysing horror.
Well, absolutely. It has to be. And some of your day is spent avoiding looking at it. I suppose I think about death every day, yes.
Why?
It's partly natural distaste for not being here. It's partly egotism. It's probably partly some sort of chemical thing in my brain. I'm surprised that most people don't think about death more than they do. I think it's one of those things that we aren't meant to think about now, or you're not meant to think about them until it's nearer the time. You know, it seems to me that it's always nearer the time. It's always too damn near the time.
Perhaps being on a desert island makes it nearer the time. We like to think that being on this desert island brings you face to face with your own mortality. Do you think, therefore, you'll be extremely miserable on the island, because death will seem even closer than it does in Tufnell Park.
Yes, I think I'll probably go mad and die, if you want the honest answer.
Mad first?
Probably mad first, yes. I mean, however nice and comfortable you make the island for me, it's still solitary confinement, isn't it? And while, as a writer, I like being alone at my desk, that's, again, dependent on the idea that, you know, at the end of the day or the week or whatever, I will have society. And if, you know, you've only got an albatross for company, I don't think it's going to be much fun.
Record number seven.
Well, record number seven, having proclaimed that I intend to go mad and die, is music to die with, if not to die for. It's Mozart's Requiem, and so why not die to the Dies Irae?
Dies Irae from Mozart's Requiem with the Monteverdi Choir and English Baroque soloists conducted by John Elliott Gardner. How much store do you set by literary prizes, Julian? You've won quite a few of them. Do you think they have a value?
Yes, they have a value, and it's usually got a pound sign in front of it. Beyond that, they have a value of giving the writer a sort of important reassurance.
But you've dismissed them before now as posh bingo.
That's right. I mean, that's the booker should be... You see, you don't write in order to win prizes. And therefore, you shouldn't be disappointed if you don't. And therefore, the only way to approach them, the only practical way to approach them, is as posh bingo. But you still, you know, don't mind cashing the cheque.
But some authors become obsessed with winning the booker, don't they?
I gather so, yes. Not me.
Not you.
No.
So the best test of a novel, really, is the obvious one, is it? That it stays in print and people buy it, and what's more, they read it.
Yes, and they like it.
Which of yours comes closest to passing that test, in your view?
Oh, I guess I'd choose Flaubert's Parrot, if only because the success that it had was completely unexpected to me.
You're just 50. Do you think a better novel in you yet? Is it possible to say? I suppose if you didn't think you had, you wouldn't write.
Yes, that's right. The answer to what's your favourite novel is the next one. Of course, you're always aiming to know more and to write better. And if you thought you've done your best work, then you should stop. I mean, there are honourable examples of writers who stop. E.M. Forster just stopped. And in that odd English way, he became more famous with every novel he didn't write.
Last record.
The last record. Well, I'm assuming that you've given me a very large pair of speakers. I'm assuming that I can manoeuvre them to point them out to sea. I'm also assuming that as I'm in the South Seas, the French Navy will still be patrolling the waters from time to time, intent on blowing up coral atolls and attacking Greenpeace protesters. So I thought that if I saw a sort of little flicker on the horizon, I would turn up the volume very loud and play them Django Reinhardt and the Hot Club of Paris.
Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli playing the Marseillaise. So if you could only take one of those eight records, Julian, which one would it be?
Mozart Requiem.
And you've got, as you know, the Bible and Shakespeare, as you called it in Flaubert's Parrot, the bare civilised minimum. What do you want as the third?
I was wondering, I can't trade in the Bible, can I? I was thinking if I could take The Joy of Cooking instead, because it's got a wonderful recipe for cooking squirrel. And I thought that I could probably transfer that to sort of various groundhogs or whatever I might discover. I think it might help me survive for longer than the Bible would.
Except that you still presumably want some Flaubert on top of that.
Oh, yes, yes. Then we come to my book.
Well, you can't have the cookery book.
I can't have the cookery book. Okay. Well, I'll just remember the recipe for squirrel. And I'd like to take Flaubert's letters rather than any of his fiction. I'd be writing my own fiction, and I thought it would be helpful to pretend that he was writing to me, that I could read two or three letters a day and imagine that that I was getting post from the outside world.
What about your luxury?
It would have to be writing equipment, an electric typewriter if I'm allowed it, lots of paper, stuff like that.
Julian Barnes, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.